Hello. Welcome to our video in the Community Information Toolkit series. Today's video is on beginning web publishing. My name is Rich Wiggins, and I would like to introduce my partner in crime, Chuck Sevens.
Well, Rich, we've got a lot to go over today, and viewers may think that this is a bit complicated when they first start out. But the more you learn, the easier it gets. So let's go ahead and get started, Rich.
Okay, Chuck. In today's video, we're going to go over the following topics. We're going to have an overview of what web publishing is all about and the HTML or hypertext markup language. We'll talk about HTML authoring tools. We'll talk about working with digital images, the various formats that you have to work with, how to use scanners and digital cameras to prepare images for the web. We'll talk about image editing software, and we'll conclude today's video with a discussion of principles of good web design. Get going, let's talk for a minute about copyright. Most content on the World Wide Web is copyrighted. And contrary to popular perception, the copyright symbol is not required for something to be copyrighted. It is generally not acceptable to pick up a piece of text or an image from a website and repurpose it unless you have permission. And that's true even if your use is nonprofit. There can be civil and criminal penalties if you fail to adhere to these rules. So the bottom line is, get permission or don't do it. A good place to find out more about copyright is the U.S. Copyright Office, and their web address appears on your screen. Before we get going talking about basic HTML and images, I want to go over sort of the range of technology choices available to you as a new webmaster or web author. Now we're going to stay pretty much in the low part of the screen here, the green part that we see, a basic web server with what we call static HTML pages. But you may want to get more advanced as you move along in web publishing. You may want to begin to move into this yellow area, get into using JavaScript or tools like animated GIFs. And when we get up into the red zone, when we talk about fancier tools like Shockwave, Active Server Pages, and so forth, that may take a little more learning. And we'll address those issues in later videos. But for today, we're talking about fairly basic stuff that nonetheless can do very powerful things. So basic HTML is going to be your primary publishing medium. Keep in mind that HTML all by itself is a very rich presentation language. And combined with inline graphics, HTML offers you many ways to control how your content is going to appear on a page. HTML can be written on any platform, you can use a wide variety of authoring tools, and you can deliver HTML using any web server. So what constitutes a web document? The basic language for the web is the hypertext markup language. And HTML editing is really analogous to using any old word processor such as Microsoft Word, except we're designing for a web browser window, not for the printed page, and that's an important distinction. The codes and tags that you use to make up an HTML document are visible unless you use an authoring tool that's a little more sophisticated that hides them. So that's a little different than using a word processor. With HTML, the text that you're putting together and the tags that control the presentation in that text will reside in the same file. So here we see in light blue HTML tags. We begin with a less than sign, we close with a greater than sign, and then we have a tag. The title tag is going to simply define the title of our document. And what we will commonly see with HTML tags is we will close a particular item, such as a title, with a slash form. So when we say slash title, that closes our overall title of community information. We'll see that pattern throughout as we learn more about HTML. Now, a common approach for handling HTML is you will edit it using a simple editor such as WordPad, and you will use a browser to preview what you're up to, and you can go back and forth between an editor and a browser. And that way you can see what will be rendered on screen, what your users will see as you do the editing. And here, just to look at a couple of sample tags, once again we have a title tag, basic web sample, and that title is going to appear in all cases in all browsers up at the top in this little blue bar. We have another kind of a tag here, the H1 tag, that defines a header. And where we have a sample HTML document, that is rendered by the browser, as we see here, a sample HTML document. Overall, our goal is going to be to prepare these HTML files and to place them on a web server somewhere. Now, a web server consists of hardware and software that is connected directly to the internet and waits to deliver your HTML documents to your customers out there. So the hypertext transfer protocol is the rules that will be used by your customers' web browsers to ask the server to deliver and to cause the delivery of HTML documents. The browser then has the job of displaying those documents on the user's screen. Some definitions. A web browser then is the software used by your users to surf the web in general and the site that you put up in particular. Now, Netscape Navigator and Microsoft Internet Explorer are the most popular, but there are other browsers, such as the Web TV browser or a browser called Opera. The web server, as we just said, is the hardware and software that delivers the web pages on demand. Now, a web page is a single HTML document as displayed on a web browser. One page may consist of more than one physical file on the server. Finally, we need to know what a URL is. URL stands for Uniform Resource Locator, and that's simply the address of a web server or a particular page on a web server. When we get into this game, we're going to deal with a few very common file types. The most basic website really only needs two file types, HTML for HTML documents, and those files will end in an extension of .html or .htm, and GIF for Graphics Interchange Format. This is a very, very popular format that's useful for all sorts of general purposes, for photographs, logos, diagrams, charts, what have you. Now, on the web, customers and publishers encounter many, many other kinds of formats. There's JPEG, for instance, which is a popular image format well suited for photographs. And there are innumerable special formats. Well, what is your job overall as a web author? You're going to prepare HTML files, either by hand or using authoring tools. You're going to prepare image files, either scanned images or those that you've created with a drawing program. You're going to organize all of these files into some sort of a coherent overall site. You're going to place the files on the server. And then finally, you're going to check to make sure that everything works. Most folks get started using manual HTML editing, and any old word processor will work just fine. A so-called flat file editor is perfectly fine for doing this application. Windows WordPad is a popular choice, or on the Macintosh, BBEdit is popular. Your general strategy will be to create and edit the files on your local hard disk. Review your progress going back and forth using the browser, and when you're satisfied, move the files to the server. So you really can start with sort of a blank slate using a text editor, and you're literally going to go in and type your HTML tags and your content all in by hand. When you're using Windows WordPad, you might simply keep one window open with WordPad and another window open with the browser, and then you can use Windows navigation tools to flip back and forth. Go down to the taskbar and simply click on whether you want to be in the browser or whether you want to be in the WordPad. So this gives you an overview of what's involved in the whole web publishing process. And next, we're going to go into what's involved in HTML in a little more detail.
Now we're going to talk about basic HTML. Now, ultimately, you may use a tool such as FrontPage to produce your HTML, but it's good to know your way around HTML because sometimes you'll see the HTML produced by these tools, and it might help to understand perhaps what's going wrong with one of your documents. So we'll start with the basic overall HTML document structure. Documents have two parts. The head is the front matter, things like the document title or the page information. The body shows the text of the page, which is the primary information that's displayed to the user. Here's some notes about HTML tags. Case does not matter. So title, regardless of whether it's upper or lowercase, are still title. Spacing in your source document doesn't matter. If you add extra spaces, they won't show up. If you can put as many carriage returns in as possible, the browser will actually rewrap the information. The browser looks at the tag and determines the ultimate layout on the screen. And this kind of can surprise you at times. One of the most common tags is a paragraph tag. This is shown by the less than P, greater than P. We have two paragraphs in this example, and we have a header level 2, and we'll talk about headers in a moment. The other thing you can see on this slide is that tags are in pairs. There's an H2 tag and then the slash H2 tag. That indicates the beginning and end of the header level 2. In headings, we have several different levels of headings ranging from level 1 to level 6. So here we see H1 is the high school, and that's the largest and boldest font, all the way down to H6, which is a rather small but still bold font. The center is material. And you can add the center around other things, such as an H1 tag. So here we have a center of an H1 tag of welcome to the Historical Society of your town, Michigan. Two other tags are the horizontal rule, indicated by HR, and the break, which is a hard carriage return. The HR draws a small horizontal line, and you can actually control the thickness of this line by adding to the HR tag, but a small horizontal line across the page, usually to separate sections of a page. The break allows you to stop the form.
You're literally going to go in and type your HTML tags and your content all in by hand.
Perfect example of the use of the break tag, because it doesn't add any extra space the way a paragraph tag would add an extra space. An important part of HTML are the hypertext links. The anchor tag is what's used to do this. All anchor tags have three basic parts. The first part is the beginning anchor tag. And it's A, href, and that stands for hypertext reference, and then the location to go to when this text is pointed to or clicked on by the user, then the text that's appeared as the link, and then the slash A to indicate the end of the anchor tag. You use this to create links to other websites. So in this example, we have an A href in the light blue, HTTP, yada, la, 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 and that's a URL, and then the words go to the Milford Community Network, and then the A. And then when this is rendered by the browser, you see the go to Milford Community Network is underlined and highlighted in a different color, and this indicates to the user that this is a clickable area. When the user clicks on this, their browser will be redirected to the URL that's in the href in this particular example. Other things you can do is set the background colors. For example, on the body tag, you can extend it by adding BG color. And in this example, we use 0000FF. That may look like a lot of gobbledygook, and in some sense it is. It turns out it's three numbers specifying the intensity of the red, the green, and the blue, respectively. So the first is the 0, in this example, 00 is the red, the second 00 is the green, and the third FF is the maximum blue. And so this ends up with a blue background. No red, no green, and all blue. These are hexadecimal numbers for those of you who are interested. Some browsers have extensions that have simplified ways of specifying the background color. You can also specify a background image. Again, this is an extension to the body tag. You say body, and then you say background equals, and then you give a file. It also is a reference. In this case, we use mi.gif for a GIF image, and then this image is repeated across the background of the page as necessary by the browser. Tables are an important way of organizing information. Sometimes you see tables without borders to make things line up. The start of the table is table, and then the slash table is the end of the table at the very bottom. Each row is started by a TR tag and ended by a slash TR tag. And then the TD and slash TD, they're effectively tabbing across the table. So in that first row with A, B, and C, you have horizontal elements A, B, and C, and then move to the second row, and then D, E, and F. Now again, there are many extensions to these tags that allow alignment and various other things that you will ultimately get to if you're going to do more advanced HTML. But this is a basic idea of tables. You can create links internally to your own documents, sort of they're stored in the same directory as the index file. In this example, we're linking to a file called about.html. About the Historical Society. In this way, when you move the whole directory of information, it moves around. So this is what's called a relative link. The way that you place an image into the HTML document is with the IMG tag. You say IMG source equals, and then you give the name of a file containing either a GIF or a JPEG image. Another aspect of the IMG tag is the alt tag. And what happens is some people turn off images in their browsers if they're on particularly slow links, and the alt tag gives a text representation of what the image would be in case the image is not downloaded for one reason or another. So we see three examples of doing this. First, we see just a basic image, image source equals yahoo.gif. Then we see the image that is part of an href. We see an image and then an href to Yahoo. And you see on the right side, the image and then the word Yahoo underlined as an href. And in the third example, we actually make the image a clickable hypertext reference. And so you see the ahref, http://www.yahoo.com. And then you see image source equals yahoo.gif. So this is in the middle of the href, you actually see the image tag. And so on the right, you'll notice that the Yahoo GIF is highlighted. There's a border around it. That means that it is the clickable area. The word Yahoo is not part of the href, and so it's not highlighted. Now, when you put your files on a server, you will have a directory that you'll be given by the system administrator. In our example, we'll use home web data. And then within that, you organize your files on the server. So you might have index.html, and it might reference in an image tag picture.gif. But then you can create subdirectories and then reference your pages into those subdirectories. And in the subdirectory, you might have an index.html file, another picture, a topic.html, another GIF. And then you organize your things together. And as your website gets more complicated, you'll tend to organize it much like you organize a hard disk. A URL is an important part of web pages. Now, they may seem a bit confusing at times, but the key is if you understand what they're doing, it makes a little more sense. They really have three basic elements. The first part, most commonly seen as HTTP colon, is actually telling what protocol to use to retrieve this document. The second part, www.smallville.mi.us, is the domain name of a web server. So we have a protocol, but then we have a server that we contact using that protocol. And the last part is the path to a particular file to retrieve on that server. And so in this one, events/may.html, that's somewhere in the directory structure on that particular server. So those are the basics. These basics tags and some simple inline images, you can actually build a surprisingly effective website. And these pages, as long as you keep things simple, download very rapidly. So my suggestion is go ahead and start writing some web pages now, take a look at what you do, add features one at a time, and pretty soon you'll learn the fancier tricks of the trade somewhat later. Now what we're going to talk about next is HTML authoring tools.
Now let's talk about HTML authoring tools. Authoring tools fall into two broad categories. Tools that are translators that translate documents from some existing format into HTML, from Microsoft Word, WordPerfect, PageMaker, etc., as compared to HTML editors. These are tools where you can start off preparing your HTML documents. Many HTML editors will allow what you see is what you get, or WYSIWYG kind of editing, where you type away and see it on the screen in an approximation of what it's going to look like in the browser. Examples of HTML editors include Adobe PageMill, Netscape Composer, HTML Assistant Pro, and Microsoft FrontPage. When you're using an editor, some of the things that you do will be so much easier that you'll say, wow, I wish I'd never done manual HTML. For instance, we just saw how tables work in HTML. And getting all your TRs and TDs working right can be a little bit confusing. With an HTML editor, you often have a graphical way of creating the table, enlarging it, moving the cells around in size, and so forth. And you can let the editor do the hard work of generating the actual HTML code instead of doing it by hand. Here we see an example of using Adobe PageMill, and we're doing some fairly basic editing. And with PageMill, for instance, if we wanted to change the color of a background, or we want to change the color of some text, we have very simple drag and drop ways of doing these sorts of things. You simply highlight the text, you go down to a pick list, and you say, I'd like this to be in red, and instantly it's done. You don't have to learn things like body, BG color, and so forth. You let the authoring tool do the work. Forms is another example of where an authoring tool can really help you out. For a lot of applications on the web, you'll want to be able to ask your users questions. And forms in HTML are the way that you'll do this. And there are different elements to a form. There are things called radio buttons, where they click on all the items that they want to select. There are fill-in forms and so forth. And as you can see over on the left, you can generate a lot of HTML code to specify a fairly simple form. It's often easier to use an authoring tool to accomplish this task. Now, another piece of handling forms is going to be the processing on the server side after the user enters their data. And in the next video in this series, we talk a little bit about the Common Gateway interface and about databases as approaches to handling forms. But in terms of creating the forms, use an authoring tool to make your job easier. FrontPage is an example of an authoring tool that's pretty sophisticated. It's a Microsoft product now, and it's, besides being an authoring tool, sort of an entire project manager for your web endeavor. You do have what you see is what you get editing. You have the ability to add pages and links to your website using graphical commands. And you build an entire web as you start each new project. And in fact, you can think of FrontPage as more of a site editor or a web editor than a page editor. You're not really doing things just a page at a time. You're building these pages together into a coherent site. One of the nice things about FrontPage is it gives you multiple views of your site. So you can look at things in different ways, and we'll see some examples in a minute here. FrontPage also offers some built-in tools for very specific applications. So for common kinds of things that people tend to want to do on a website, comment forms, simple discussion forums, and the like, FrontPage can allow you to build these very quickly. Now the downside is you have to run FrontPage extensions on your server to get the most effectiveness out of these applications. Here's one of the views that you'll see in FrontPage. Here we're going through and looking at how our site is navigable. Chuck explained how you can have links to other pages on your own site or on other sites. Well, with the navigation view in FrontPage, you see the relationship among all the pages that you're putting together. And you can add pages using this view. So you can simply say, I want to add another page here by hitting the insert button. And then you'll be popped into the editor and you can create that page. It's a very simple and coherent way to build a site. The folder view lets you look at the very same web that you're building from the perspective of the files on your hard disk. And this is very simple, similar to using any Windows Explorer or any file system explorer. And you have things such as the timestamps on the files, and you also see things in a hierarchical or folder view. The hyperlink view allows you to visualize links in a different way. You can go through and see what the links are within your documents and elsewhere on the World Wide Web. So you can use all these different views in FrontPage as a way to understand your site from different perspectives. Here's the FrontPage editor in the normal view. And this looks pretty darn close to a browser window. So this really is what you see is what you get editing. The FrontPage editor in HTML view allows you to see the tags. And as Chuck mentioned, sometimes it's useful to be able to go back and actually see the generated HTML code. One of the things FrontPage tries to do is give you the ability to build pages and entire sites with very little work on your part. For instance, it's a good idea on many websites to think about having a single theme that applies to every page in the site. And with FrontPage, you have a set of predefined themes. You pick one of these themes, in this case we picked downtown as a theme, and that will give you graphical elements and menu bars that you can apply page by page throughout the site without any additional work. Similarly, you can have templates for different kinds of pages that you want to have in a site. For instance, there's a normal page template, a bibliography template, a guest book template, and so forth. So this is sort of like what you see in some word processors where you'll have a predefined template for a letter versus a memo versus some other kind of a document. This way you can prepare a page very quickly without having to go through and design your own layout for the particular page. What's it like managing files with authoring tools? Many authoring tools make it a lot easier to create pages and then publish them by putting them on the server through a process called one-button publishing. Now, this can be a little bit tricky to set up. You have to set it up on the server side and on the desktop of the person who's doing the authoring. The webmaster may have to install some extensions on the server to make all of this work. But once it's been set up, each author can simply click the publish button when they're done editing a page, and poof, that page goes off to the server. If you don't have this sort of one-button publishing tool available to you, you're going to have to move files around manually. So you may have a number of files that make up a directory or a folder on your own desktop, and you're going to have to move all of those files off to the server. You might use a tool like WSFTP for the file transfer protocol under Windows. And here we're going to select a number of files using a graphical interface. We're going to tell it to move those files, such as logo.jpg, off to our server. By contrast, if we're using a tool that offers one-button publishing, such as Netscape Composer, we'll set up a relationship between us and the server, and then we click the Publish button, and our content will be sent off to the server to the place that we've specified. Now, obviously, you're going to have to give it a username and a password so that not anybody on the planet can go and publish to your website. But once you've done a little bit of setup, the one-button publish is really the way to go. Let's talk about site management in general. Some authoring tools really do provide ways to manage an entire site, not just a random collection of pages. They may offer other advanced features for you. For instance, one feature would be checking link integrity. Well, what do I mean by link integrity? If your pages are going to have links among each other and then off to the rest of the web, sometimes you're going to make a mistake. You're going to misspell the address of a page. You're going to link to a site that isn't available anymore. And tools that can check link integrity can go through exhaustively an entire collection of pages and verify that the links are good. Another feature might be the ability to validate HTML to make sure that all of your tags are valid. If you misspell the title tag, the browser won't know what to do with it. So validation makes sure that your pages have good, correct HTML tags. FrontPage even has some project management features. You can actually assign tasks to members of your FrontPage team. You can set priorities, and you can keep up with, you can track their progress on updating pages. Here's an example of what the FrontPage project management screen would look like. We've assigned some tasks to several individuals on our team. We notice that one member of the team has completed his task, but the others haven't started yet. As they get things done using FrontPage, the task manager can automatically update the status. Now, we've been talking about authoring tools and some of the nice things they can do for us. Suppose you're in an environment where you haven't invested in an authoring tool yet. You're still doing manual HTML editing. There are some websites that will actually help you evaluate and validate your own website. There are tools that will examine your site and check for HTML validity, for link integrity, even for the speed of page downloads to see how fast it would be to download your page over a dial-up modem versus a cable modem. They'll even check to see whether your GIF images have been optimized, whether they're as small as they can possibly be made for efficient download. So these sites can offer you many of the advantages of your own authoring tool installed on your own computer, but they're coming from a remote location. It's also very easy to apply these tools to an entire site. NetMechanic is an example of one of these tools, and you can see the various kinds of checks it will do. Load time, GIF image checking, link checking, HTML checking, and so forth. With NetMechanic, you visit the NetMechanic site, you give it a URL or a starting point of what you want to have tested. You tell it whether you want it to test this particular page or the entire site, and then you give it a set of rules to work against. The current HTML standard is the HTML 4.0 draft. You might want to pick that. You might want to pick Microsoft Internet Explorer extensions and so forth. It's probably better to stick with a standard such as the HTML draft. You give it your email address, you tell it to take off, and it crunches away. If you've told it to do an entire site and they take a period of time to complete the task. When you get the results back, you'll have a report. Click on a hyperlink and you can see all the good stuff and all the bad stuff on your site. Whatever shows up in red will be either a cautionary note or an error of some sort in one of your tags. And you probably want to take a look at this and go back and fix the errors. So that's our overview of HTML authoring tools, and I would encourage you to pick one, such as Netscape Composer or FrontPage, and give it a try. Chuck?
What do you got there?
Say cheese.
Cheese.
What have I just done?
You've used a high-performance computing device to, what have you done?
I've taken your picture with a digital camera.
Oh, slick.
And the nice thing about this is it's perfectly well-suited for the webmaster.
Right.
Because in the old days, we'd take pictures on a 35-millimeter film. We'd take it to the drugstore or to the photo processor and get it developed. Be a lot of lag time before that picture appeared on the website.
Right.
With a digital camera, it's a lot easier. We can review the stuff on the camera using the screen on the back. We can transfer it electronically into a computer, send it off to the server, and we're ready to publish it.
Is that the only choice folks have?
No. Another choice would be you can, at many photo processors, ask them to send you back a disk.
Right.
And they will go ahead and do the conventional 35-millimeter processing,
right,
but then they will scan your images in and give you back a whole bunch of JPEG files that are suitable for putting up on the web.
Well, for the right people, that's very convenient.
It's extremely convenient. It's low cost, relatively speaking. And for a lot of applications, it may take a day or so more to get the disk back, but for a lot of applications, that's the way to go.
Well, there's other choices, too. I mean, sometimes people have paper. Like
documents.
Historical documents that they want to do, and that's when they would use something like this, a scanner.
Flatbed scanner.
That might be connected to their computer, and that way they get the image in and they put it up on the web.
Okay.
So that's the entire theme for this segment is working with digital images. And as we've already demonstrated, you have a number of image input choices for digital images. We've got digital cameras, we've got scanners, and we can have the photo lab deliver the material in digital form, whether it's floppies or a photo CD, and some of them will even just ship you back a URL that allows you to access your images as JPEGs. There are a number of different kinds of scanners. The basic purpose of a scanner is to move from paper to a digital document. You can put on newsletters, pages from books, photographs, and even small objects can be scanned. The way you scan stuff depends on what the purpose is of the scan. You may want to scan a photograph or a crisp line art or even scan text for ultimate optical character recognition. Most applications call for flatbed scanners like we have here on the set. They're useful for most everyday applications. Some offer automatic sheet feeders if you're going to have very high volume bulk kind of scanning jobs. But there's many other scanners that exist. You can scan a 35-millimeter slide or a negative at very, very high resolution. And there's book scanners and handheld scanners. And there's even business card scanners. There are many, many brands to choose from when choosing a scanner: Hewlett-Packard, Visionear, Canon, Epson, or UMAX. The quality of these varies with price. If you're going to do heavy-duty work, you'll probably want to buy a more expensive one, at least $300. The more expensive scanners tend to offer better resolution and faster scanning speed. Faster scanning speed is something very important if you're going to be sitting at this all day long. You'll want at least 600 dots per inch optical resolution, look for at least 24-bit color, and check for the bed size and the speed of the scan. Now, an important part of the scanner often is the software that comes with the scanner, because just scanning the data in doesn't often do you any good. You will need some kind of image editing software. Rich will probably talk about this coming up. Adobe Photo Deluxe or Corel Photo Paint are two examples of common packages. Also, if you're going to do optical character recognition, you'll need software for that. OmniPage and Xerox TextBridge are good examples of that. Related tools is you may use Adobe Acrobat to prepare materials, or fax software, or image file managers. To install your scanner, you unpack it. It'll often come with a CD-ROM that includes the software to support the scanner, as well as often image editing software. You connect the scanner to your PC. You can connect it with either a parallel printer port. It uses pass-through to your printer, meaning that you can still connect the printer. You simply connect the scanner in between the computer and the printer. SCSI is generally the high-performance connection, but not all PCs have it, but Macs have this connection. The newest connection is the USB, or Universal Serial Bus. The nice thing about this is you plug it in and it auto-installs under Windows 98. So you take a USB scanner, you plug it into your USB port, it detects the new piece of equipment without even rebooting, does automatic software installation, and as long as your PC has a USB port, this is a convenient way to connect your scanner. So these are the basic steps in scanning. You position your original on the bed, you close the cover, hopefully the power is on, you start the software, you select preview, then when you see the preview of the page, use the mouse to select the part of the page you want to scan, or scan the entire page. So here we go. You have a flatbed scanner, you take some material, and you're going to put it face down on the bed. You select the preview, and it pulls up a rough image of what the scanned information is, and then you identify the area with the drag bar. You drag out the area that you want to truly scan. You have to select the output type, and this tells the scanner and the software what you're ultimately going to use this for. And in this case, we're going to do OCR, so we tell it that we're scanning text. And that has to do with how it enhances the information and how it stores it for optimum use. The resolution is an important part of many things that you're going to scan. A relatively low resolution may work surprisingly well, such as 150 dots per inch. It's important to remember that computer monitor screens only offer about 72 dots per inch, so much higher, and you have resolution that can't even be displayed on a monitor. Now, the purpose for higher resolutions may be that you're going to actually allow your viewers to download the information and view it offline. You also may want to do it if you're going to manipulate the file with an image editor and create a high-quality offline version of the file for storage and for archiving purposes. Now, optical character recognition is a common use of scanners. And in this example, we scanned this letter from the AFC, and the software was remarkably reliable, about 98% accurate. And so this is a very good use. The software has gotten more and more sophisticated in optical character recognition. So, to summarize, here are some scanning tips. We're going to scan multi-column text, one column at a time. Choose the right resolution and take a look at your photographs. Choose a vector format if you're scanning in a logo or graphic to reuse. And use the image editor to crop, resize, and fine-tune. And make sure to watch the file sizes on what you serve. If you serve things as TIFF images, they're going to be gigantic. Now, an important part of once you've got digital images is manipulating those digital images. So coming up next, we're going to talk about digital image editing tools.
Now let's talk about how to manipulate those images that Chuck explained how you're going to get into your computer using image editing software. You're going to want to get a good image editing program. You might look out on the internet for a tool like PaintShop Pro, which is a shareware program that's quite popular. Or you might want to invest in Adobe Photoshop, which is sort of the most important tool used in the publishing industry for this purpose. Now, there's a stripped-down version of Photoshop called Adobe Photo Deluxe, which is available for purchase, and it often comes bundled with scanners and with digital cameras. This is a powerful tool in its own right, and one nice thing about Photo Deluxe is that a lot of the complicated procedures in Photoshop have been endowed with very user-friendly front ends, so it's real easy to do things in Photo Deluxe. Another commercial tool that's popular is Corel Photo Paint. What can these image editors do for you? They can convert among the various image formats from GIF to JPEG to TIFF and other formats. They can rotate images. If you've taken a picture with a digital camera and it's oriented the wrong way, you can rotate the image. They can resize images or crop them. You can remove unwanted elements from a photograph, let's say. Note that the standard video monitor that your customers are going to be using is going to have at least 640 by 480 pixels, and you're going to want to make sure that your image sizes will fit within a browser window that fits within at least that least common denominator window. Otherwise, they're going to have to scroll left and right and up and down to see the entire image. Other functions that can be performed by image editors, you can adjust the contrast, the brightness, the number of colors used to represent the image. You can add text to an image. You can take a photograph and turn it into a very nice logo for the beginning or splash screen of your site. You can even combine images into a collage of sorts. And you can apply a variety of special effects. Here's an example of using Adobe Photo Deluxe to manipulate an image. Now, as you see, we have a menu bar that allows us to do a lot of different transformations. Some of these are useful for portraits of people. For instance, it's got a very quick and easy way to remove a red eye. You can take a photo that's got some imperfections and you can restore it. If you've got a photo that's got elements in it that you don't like, you can actually remove those from the photograph, and so forth. Now, in this case, let's say we want to apply a special effect in Photo Deluxe, and we want this picture of Lake Louise to look like it's scrolling up off the page. This is a very useful kind of an approach. You may want to take this sort of an image and lay it down on a web page, and now this could be perhaps a hyperlink or a metaphor of turning the page and advancing in the site. An image editor like Photo Deluxe can also perform this kind of a transformation, where we've taken that same photograph and we've sort of applied an edge filter against it, and we've turned it into something that looks like hand-drawn line art. So that's one of the other kinds of special effects that image editing software can do for you. And I can't emphasize the vast number of different effects that are available. So my advice is to go get a tool like Photo Deluxe, play with it, and learn all the different options available to you. When you're working with digital images, understand that it's going to be very, very important to reduce the file size of your images to the minimum possible to still convey meaning. A lot of people will put up an image on a website that's 100 kilobytes or larger, and they're making the mistake of designing their site as if everyone has infinitely fast bandwidth for navigating the pages. 100 kilobytes is too large. You should have no more than 14 or 15 or 20 kilobytes worth of images on a page, unless you have a compelling reason to violate that rule. Well, how do you get there? You can reduce the size of the image using one of these editors. You can reduce the number of colors in a color image, and that will actually lower the file size. And you can use a GIF optimizer that you might find in your image editing software. And this will go through and apply some standard transformations to try to optimize the size of your files. Another common technique is to use what are called thumbnails. Instead of delivering a full-size image to your users by default, offer a small thumbnail, a small little representation, sort of almost an icon, of what the larger image is going to look like. Now, with the thumbnail concept, we use the anchor or hyperlink that Chuck explained earlier, and we reference the large version of a photograph. In this case, our photograph is going to be in the JPEG format, but our actual image tag refers to the small version. And if you look carefully, you'll see that this image of Lake Louise has a border around it, meaning it is, in fact, a hyperlink. If the user were to click on the smaller thumbnail, they would find that they would then see a page that includes the larger image. There's even software you can find on the net to make this easier. For instance, the program Thumbs Plus can be applied against an entire folder full of images. It will automatically generate the smaller thumbnails for you. And there's even a web wizard where it will go through and generate HTML that refers to those thumbnails. You can put both the HTML file and all of the image files, the small ones and the large ones, in a folder on your web server. And now your customers can go through and browse the thumbnails and click on the images that look like they're interesting just to see the large ones that they'd like. What's involved with working with colors on your website? Inherently, when we're representing a photograph or other image in color in a digital realm, we're going to have to make some compromises. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of control over our environment here. Video cards, monitors, and software will each have their own characteristics and limitations. And since you have a large number of users spread all over your community or all over the world, you can't control what their video cards, monitors, and software are like. There's a tendency to take the newest computer that you've got on your desktop for editing your images and assume that your users will have the same kind of high resolution and high depth color available to them. They won't. So you may have 16 million colors available to you, which is sometimes called true color, and your users may have an older PC with less capability, as few as 256 colors. So it's a good idea, first off, to keep around a more limited machine, set down the resolution and the color depth of your PC, of your video card, and view what you're presenting to people using these older kinds of devices. minimizing the number of colors is going to help you achieve the goal of reaching the broadest number of users. So what you do is you use your image editing software to cut down on the number of colors, and many of them will offer a simple option that says reduce colors. If you go to 216 or fewer distinct colors in an image, this will speed up page loading for your users, and it will also ensure better control over final display. Another option you want to find in your image editing software or in your authoring software is how to use the browser-friendly palette. There are limitations in web browsers in terms of how many different distinct colors they can handle at once. And when you're selecting text colors and so forth, the browser-friendly palette will ensure that you haven't created a page that's difficult for a browser to render. Some features you might want to explore as you get into imaging and editing of images. The GIF format, the GIF format, offers what's known as transparency. What we mean by this is we pick a single color in the image that we want to be rendered as transparent. For instance, a white wall behind a human subject. When we, in our image editor, specify transparency for that color, that means that that image is going to blend into the web page very nicely. And for instance, if it's a photograph of a person against a white wall, and we've said that white is going to act as if it's transparent, when we lay that image down on a web page, it will appear that the person is right on top of the page. If the page has a blue background, as we explained earlier, then the person will appear to lay right against the blue background. Another GIF feature you might want to explore is animation. You know all those banner ads that you see at the top of many commercial websites? Those usually use GIF animation. And it's very easy to set up animation. A lot of image editing programs or authoring tools will let you do this. For instance, you could take an image of a dog and have it show up in different spots within a frame, and it will appear that the dog is running across the frame. So this isn't all that hard to do, and it's something you'll want to explore in your authoring tools. You'll find that many of your image editors and authoring tools can accomplish transparency as well as animation. In our final segment today, we're going to go and discuss how to weave all this together and build sites that look good.
Web design is an important element of your webmastering responsibilities. What we're going to do is we're going to start talking about the characteristics of a good website. A good website is well organized, easy to navigate, attractive, useful, and very importantly, it must be kept up to date. Here's some steps, some suggestions on how you get to a well-designed website. First, have a goal. Understand why you're doing this in the first place. Understand the audience. Who is going to visit your site? Create a plan for developing and deploying your website. Select your web service provider. Try the site out. Make sure you use different people, different PCs, and different browser versions. Also, it's important to try it over slow dial-up lines, and very importantly, maintain your website once it's up. Here's some example pages. This is a page by AT&T. Clearly, they're taking the audience type approach. If you look, they've got a link about for investors. Clearly, they expect investors are going to show up at this page. There's an employment link. They're expecting potential employees to show up at this page. AT&T services, that's for potential customers. So clearly, along the left side of this page, they're looking at who's going to show up on this page and catering to those needs. This is the Michigan Electronic Library. As it is a library, it's organized by subject, which is perfectly logical. You'll also notice there's not a lot of graphics on this site. There's just enough graphics to keep it interesting. This keeps the download time relatively fast for modem users because people are going to hit this page most likely and then move on into one of the subjects. And if each of the clicks that they have to do has a whole bunch of graphics that takes 30 seconds to download, then that's going to make this site very problematic. Now, the material that you might get to on a site like this might be very graphic intensive when it's all said and done, but this is much like an index, so you want to be able to move quickly through it, even over a modem. This is the University of Michigan Academic Unit page. And as you might expect, this is organized by department. This is exactly what a user would expect. The academic outreach has which departments, and they're in a simple linear list, and so you can navigate through this very quickly and very easily. Also, a hierarchical organization may or may not be the best idea. But if you expect people to drill down from the top, like Michigan
of image editing programs or offering tools will let you do this. For instance, you could take an image of a dog and have it show up in different spots within a frame.
Now they're going to hit a county or they, and then move on their way through. So a hierarchical organization can be very appropriate when you're using it to represent something that people think of hierarchically. Here's some design elements. This Ohio State University page is very nice because it has all the important areas within the first screen, so that on a standard monitor, people will not have to scroll down to do the important things on this screen. Standard toolbars at the top or bottom or sides are very useful to give users a confidence that they can get around your site effectively. Users quickly develop the skills to scan these toolbars. They sort of, in stylistic ways, they know that the toolbars exist, and they know that the important navigation is going to be done through these toolbars. Backgrounds can be a very nice part of your website or a very bad part of the website. One of the worst things you can do with a background is distract from your main topic. So in this example, we have black text and a kind of a grayish white background. And what happens is it makes the text very, very hard to read. It kind of distracts from the message that you're actually trying to send. Now, a bunch of sort of amateur people, when they make their own web pages, they sometimes do this for shock effect. But if you're doing this for an organization and you want to communicate a message, it's not a good idea. Image maps are a very effective tool that can provide a visually nice means of navigation in a way that users can make good use of. But it's important to make clear the areas on the image maps that the users can click on. Tables are increasingly used by the more sophisticated websites to align different elements without using frames, which we'll talk about in a moment. But this Detroit News page uses frames to make this look as close to a newspaper look as possible. And the nice thing about the tables is that they move together, and as you resize your browser, the tables can take good advantage of the increased screen area. Tables are also can be done very simply. So in this page, a table is used to display simple organization of information that users can then click on. Frames are not highly recommended, they're just not recommended in very many areas. But the one use that can be used for frames that's effective is a continuous scrolling navigation window. So on the left of this Merit page, you have a scrolling navigation window that stays static throughout all the Merit sites, and then the right side displays the particular information that you've chosen. There are many awards on the site. With the millions or billions of web pages that are out there, if someone tells you that you're in the top 5%, that's not really much of a compliment. Putting your awards on your main page is much more valuable for the award company than it is for you. And usually they're using this to sell advertising. So don't feel so impressed if you get an award. If you really are obsessed by awards, then make a separate page that people can click on to say, please take a look at our many awards here. So here's some tips. Emulate a site that you like. Pick a style for that site. Test the style before you build the entire site. Keep things simple. Providing a search function is very helpful to people. Test your site for legibility and navigation, and have other people test your site. So Rich, that's a bit of an overview of web design. Do you have any other thoughts?
Yes, I think the point about emulating a site that does a good job is really a good strategy
right.
to follow.
That's one of the great things about the web.
Right.
You go and you click on View Source and you say, wow, that's how the Detroit News did it.
The web wouldn't be what the web is if it wasn't for the ability to go and
I think you're absolutely right. People would come up with a great idea and they would keep it all to themselves.
You can also find a number of wonderful sites on the web that will help you learn about HTML and design.
Or JavaScript. Or
what have you.
Right.
And then, of course, if you go to the bookstore, you can find some really good books.
Yeah, you brought some books with you.
I'd like to mention three in particular
okay.
that are really good to consider. One gets to the issue of how do you design your site where it's friendly for people to find what they're looking for. And this is by a couple of authors in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it's called Information Architecture for the World Wide Web. And it does a really good job of giving you, the webmaster, the perspective of your users. And that's an important message that you need to understand.
Oh, that's an absolutely very, absolutely a very important message that you've got to step back. And the AT&T site, I think, is a good demonstration
yes.
of you could have seen the internal org chart of AT&T as it's bought companies and morphed them together. Who cares about that? I'm an investor. I want to buy some stock. Give me a little
right.
click on.
Another book that I like, apropos of today's theme, is the Amazing Photo Deluxe book, because this tells you how, in very short order, to do some of the effects that we alluded to earlier.
I think people should buy books for Photo Deluxe and Photoshop, because those tools are not always immediately intuitive to use. But I find that with a book, you can quickly get things up to get up to speed in those pieces of software.
And then finally, Designing Web Graphics. This is the second edition by Linda Weinman. This is for the person who's working with images who wants to go to the really sophisticated level of tuning your images and choosing the right format and making your graphics really zing. So you might start with Photo Deluxe, and once you've gotten polished, you might advance to Photoshop software and learn about it using this book.
Could I borrow that book?
Yeah, as a matter of fact.
Thanks. I think I could use this. I'm half decent at images, but I certainly have a little bit more to use.
And while you're reading that book, we're going to have to say goodbye, and we'll look forward to seeing everybody's site up on the web. Thank you.